third member of this panel. She was not able to be here today. She is listening to the argument. She does not plan to ask questions during the argument, but she is fully participating in the case. Okay, our first case this morning is number 17-2304, AbbVie Biotechnology Limited versus United States. Mr. Saunders.
Morning, these appeals involve AbbVie's groundbreaking claims. The original dosing regimen, the best-selling drug in the world to market, the first long-chain antibody ever approved for subcutaneous administration, any antibody or any condition. And declaring these
the claims are on a method, right? They're not on the actual antibody itself.
Right, the claims are on the dosing.
The dosing, okay.
And that was the first subcutaneous administration of antibody ever approved by the FDA. And in declaring the claims obvious, the board made a series of legal errors in which it shifted the burden on the AbbVie to resolve uncertainty that should have been against obviousness. It failed to consider all of the claim elements in combination with long-term treatment for at least 24 weeks. It plucked individual statements from references without the full context of what they taught, and it analyzed commercial success under a framework that this court has
One of your main points is that the 0.5 milligram kilogram dosage in these prior art studies wasn't effective, right? And for example, on page 4 of your reply brief, I guess you collect the evidence here that deals with that. And you say, Rao disclosed that 58% of patients receiving 0.5 milligram kilogram never achieved an ACR 20 response at any point in time. But that strikes me as a bit misleading because, for example, if you look at Kempenny at appendix 2304, it shows a 70% response to the weekly 0.5 milligram.
Kempenny?
Yes, Kempenny, and then Rao also teaches 78% moderate response on 28085. But let's look first at 2704, which is Kempenny, and it says there's a weekly, this is table 2 at the bottom. This says weekly 0.05 milligram to kilogram sub-SC, that is subcutaneous injections, is an ACR 20 response of 70%.
Oh, yeah, I understand. So that is weekly dosing. So the claims here are every other week dosing. So when you're talking about 0.5 milligram per kilogram weekly dosing, you're talking about essentially double what we have in the claims here. And so the point is that to reach its obvious determination, the board was combining weekly subcutaneous doses from the DSE7 study that Vanderbilt references with the at least every other week intravenous weight-based doses from the PE3 study, which is mainly reported in Rao. And the glaring problem with that was that for the allegedly equivalent 0.5 milligram per kilogram dose in that DE3 study, you had persistent updosing. Indeed, before you add the uncertainty of moving to subcutaneous doses, fixed doses across the patient population,
you're referring to DE and then some number, and you know, you'll have to forgive me. The way I think about it is, you know, certain excerpts that I've read from certain references. For example, Kempenny. I know Kempenny is telling me that they were talking about how you can administer D2E7 biweekly, intravenously, at 0.5 milligrams per kilogram, which, as I understand it, people seem to agree is roughly 40 milligrams. So 40 milligrams taken every other week. And then I see here an explanation that that seems to have a pretty positive outcome. I understand that it says for those who did not respond, got updosed, but it's not so clear to me that that suggests everyone that got 0.5 milligrams per kilogram did not respond well.
Right, so Kempeny reports updosing, and then a person of ordinary
strength. For those who didn't respond well.
Right, for those who didn't respond well. And then when you look at the reports on the same study in Rao 2000, and so that's, you know, Blue Brief at page 39, we show charts. It's undisputed that by week 12, after week 12, every single patient who had been on that dose was updosed.
Yeah, but that says specifically they were updosed because it was a study to determine safety, and they wanted to give them the larger dose to measure safety.
Well, the statement about why they were updosed was the statement in Penny that it's for patients who, quote, did not respond well.
Yeah, but the purpose of it was to measure safety. It wasn't to measure efficacy. They weren't abandoning the thing because it wasn't efficacious. They were changing it at 12 weeks because they wanted to measure safety at the higher dose.
But for every 0.5 milligram per kilogram dose in the chart, there was updosing. And it didn't say we are doing this just for dose escalation. It was patients are not.
Well, what page of the appendix is this on?
So, Kempeny, page 2704, talks about patients who don't respond well.
2704.
This is the quote. It's also on 28080, right? Kempeny's in the appendix twice.
Yes.
So what it says is to keep as many patients as possible in the study for the long-term evaluation of safety, patients who did not respond, et cetera, et cetera. It's focusing on a change in the dosage because they wanted to measure safety.
Well, if the DE3 study that we talked about here is something about which you're only going to make determinations of safety.
No, but I'm talking about the language. To keep as many patients as possible, the study for the long-term evaluation of safety, patients who did not respond well after 0.05 or 1 milligram received higher doses.
Right, the discussion of safety is because these are the phase 1 clinical trials for which you're looking at safety, but the board's obviousness combination depends on relying on the efficacy.
No, but the point is that they didn't take them off the 0.05 dosage because of lack of efficacy. They did it in order to measure safety, correct?
Well, we asked both of the other side's experts about this and said, for Coherus's expert, this is appendix 6189, for D2E7, are there any possible reasons for updosing other than the fact that patients were not responding well? Your answer was that would be speculation.
But look, I'm reading the study itself. Forget about the characterizations. It says, because they updosed them because they wanted to conduct a long-term evaluation of safety, right?
Wait, they wanted to conduct a long-term evaluation of safety, and they were losing patients, the patients who were not responding well. And so they were updosing the patients to keep them in the study rather than have them continue with the inadequate response.
Well, it doesn't say that, but That's another issue. If you look at these tables, I guess they are 4 and 5 in RAL, these show that the 0.05 dose in fact, after 12 weeks, was about as effective as the higher doses, right?
No, the undisputed expert testimony on that is that's highly misleading. These are averages. And so when you have updosing like this, the other side's expert was asking,
let's just take the charts for the moment. We'll put aside the experts. These charts show that in terms of the measurement here of efficacy, it's about the same after 12 weeks, right? Or even perhaps a little better in chart 5.
The number that is being shown for 0.5 milligram, there's no way whatsoever of knowing how many patients are left. So you would be talking about
I'm not talking about after 12 weeks. I'm talking about at 12
weeks. At 12 weeks with updosing, as patients are dropping out, and 0.31387 in the appendix, 31389, the other side's expert in the codes. And he says, I can't say for any of those points how many patients are left. And that's a big problem when you're looking at this. We in at 2949 put in the FDA guidance for rheumatoid arthritis drugs in 1999. And it talks about dropouts in the problem. It says, quote, since dropouts do not usually occur randomly, remaining patients constitute a biased subsample of the patients originally randomized.
That may be, but the chart is the same thing is true for all the dosages. And the chart shows that in terms of efficacy at week 12, it's about the same, right?
All the other doses are showing averages across the patients. Where you have updosing, you can't compare that because you're taking out. If you take out all the people who aren't succeeding, then the average is going to...
What tells us that in this period up to the 12-week mark that people were taken out of the study who were receiving the 0.05?
The description of updosing. The patients who were being updosed were being switched to the 1 milligram per kilogram dose. And in addition, new patients were coming in at week 6. Patients who
Where does it say that?
That says that the placebo patients are coming in at week 6. That's at page 4593 of the appendix. Placebo patients came in. So
wait, 4596?
4593, the appendix.
Okay, where does it say that?
You look starting at the third line from the third injection on. However, the study was open label.
Well, I'm sorry, where?
The third line, 4593, from the third injection on, however, the study was open label. Patients who had been receiving placebo during the placebo control period were switched to the corresponding dose of D2E7.
What does that have to do with what I was asking about, which is the lower dose?
Because for the person who is being shown at week 12, the central point here is that with updosing the study, that could be as few as one patient, and it could be a patient who never even entered the study.
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding where you're getting that from. The sentence you showed me had to do with patients who are receiving placebo.
Right, that is for the fact that it could be people only who've been on the dose for 6 weeks.
But that's about placebo. That wasn't what my question was.
This is patients who switch from placebo. So the doses are structured where you have patients being dosed, and then connected with each of those, you have a placebo set of patients, and those continue together from week 6. At week 6, the placebo patients get switched onto the corresponding dose. So you have people going on to the 0.5 milligram per kilogram dose for the very first time, at week 6.
Well, that would be true of the other doses, too.
Absolutely,
right?
It would be true of the other doses.
So that sort of suggests that the chart doesn't show anything at all.
Well, if the chart doesn't show anything at all, then...
But that's not an argument you've made.
No.
What you have argued is that these charts show superiority for the higher doses. And what I'm pointing out to you is that that's true in the DE-001 study, which stops much earlier, but it's not true for the 12-week point on the chart.
Where you're comparing apples to oranges, and remember we have claims that are specifically requiring efficacy for at least 24 weeks. So if everybody's going in 12 weeks, there's complete absence of data. And I'd also say this isn't my description. Vow itself singles out praise the doses greater than 1 milligram/kilogram and criticizes the doses at 0.5.
Yes, but that's for the DE-001 study, not for the 3 study, which takes it up to 12 weeks.
No, the Rao criticism, the Rao statement about greater than 1 milligram/kilogram, that's at 2805 in the appendix, is its description of the statistically significant.
If you look at 28085, it talks about the 0.5 milligram over 12 weeks resulted in a moderate response in 78% of the patients, right?
Correct, averaging up to 10 milligram per kilogram. And so what we have here is...
Okay, I don't want to take up all of your time. Why don't you move on to another subject unless Judge Chin has other questions about this?
No.
We'll give you some more. We'll give you a couple more minutes here. No, you don't need to sit down. You can talk now.
Oh, okay. I would say, in addition to the first issue, and I think what we are talking about here is a fundamental point of uncertainty that was resolved against us to put the burden on us to resolve that uncertainty. We should count it against obviousness. We saw the same thing on the semen levels. These are the trough concentrations between doses, where when you stretch a dose like this, you may be giving the same total amount of doses, but it's undisputed you get dips, larger dips between the doses. And the board's response to that was to say, well, the minimum effective dose was undefined in June 2001, so we would have disregarded the fact that you're going to a lower minimum. That is exactly our point. The minimum effective dose was undefined. There wouldn't have been assurance.
But what if, as I understand the board, they had Vandeput, we haven't talked about that yet, which showed, albeit weekly administration subcutaneously, 20 milligrams, 40 milligrams, 80 milligrams, were all statistically superior over placebo, and likewise, they were all essentially equivalent in terms of their effectiveness. That's what Vandeput says. Now we go over to Kempeni and we see, okay, you can take a 40 milligram equivalent, 0.5 milligrams per kilogram, biweekly, do it intravenously, and what if we just accept for now that substantial evidence supports the idea that Kempeni also supports that would be give you a good enough response? Maybe not as good of a response as 1 milligram per kilogram or 3 milligrams per kilogram, but nevertheless, good enough that would be something that would be considered a positive outcome. So when you look at all of that and then say, well, we already know that taking it biweekly is going to get you a decent result at roughly the same amount as 40 milligrams. That is to say 5 milligrams per kilogram. So therefore there's a reasonable basis to go from that 0.5 milligram per kilogram to a fixed 40 milligram dosage every other week.
Right, so I think there are two issues with that. So even setting aside up dosing, when you're talking about numbers of Vandeput, we're talking about going to semen levels that are below anything we saw. Even though the other side's expert said you would want a dose at or above the semen level shown in the prior art. And when you go over to 0.5 milligram per kilogram to try try to give yourself that assurance, we have to remember that those are intravenous weight-based doses that then are being converted over. You'd be saying, well, what if we're taking those over to subcutaneous doses? And you know, with the loss of bioavailability that occurs when you, rather than are injecting it straight into the bloodstream, you're injecting it under the skin, and it has to be absorbed. And then also the claims are bringing together that with fixed doses, meaning you have to have a dose that is working across the patient population. It gives you less margin of error to say, I'm going to go as low as possible when people were being individually dosed.
But it was known in the art to give a fixed dosage. Vandeput's a clear example of that.
Well, it may be known in other arts to give a fixed dosage. I think we should remember here, at this time, there was one antibody approved as the anti-TNF-alpha antibody, and it is dosed intravenously, weight-based doses. At this time, there are zero antibodies, any kind, any condition, that are approved for subcutaneous administration. This is very, very, very early in this art here. And so the a sort of abstract principle.
Kempeny says subcutaneous administration would be a promising approach, and says that they're comparable, the subcutaneous and the intravenous administrations.
Talking about results achieved with different doses. I think one of the hard things here is you have claims that are bringing together both the dose that is absolutely on the low end with subcutaneous administration, with the fixed dose, and with the longer dosing interval. And so you can look, and this is one of the issues with the board's opinion, is you can look in isolation and say, oh, well, these would be equivalent, but the context for that is talking about higher doses.
But it doesn't have to be equivalent, right? I mean, the claims only require some efficacy. It doesn't require a particular level of efficacy saying use the most effective one. And your theory, I guess, is that in terms of motivation to combine, that you would use the higher dose to achieve the greater efficacy?
Well, you would, it's not necessarily rare because it's ensuring that you would get efficacy in the context of there being not usual pressures to go to the lower dose, in the sense that BI's expert.
But these studies show considerable efficacy at the 0.5 level. It may be slightly below at 12 weeks what you get from the higher dosage, but you on the face, these things show efficacy at the 0.5 level at 12 weeks.
I mean, let's zero in on 24-week claims. Rao and Benny don't have anything to teach about 0.5 milligram dose at 24 weeks, because it's undisputed. Whatever the reason, it's completely discontinued.
Wouldn't it be obvious to keep treating someone with rheumatoid arthritis past 12 weeks, though?
We have to talk about the reasonable expectation of success. And that's where, when you look at the statements in RAB about the fact that the erythrocyte sedimentation rate, which is a measure of inflammation, is getting worse again after only 1 week. And the fact that there was updosing, and the fact that when Rao talks about long-term treatment, it says, yes, we got long-term efficacy with the doses greater than 1 milligram per kilogram. So there's a complete absence of information reported in the prior art there in the DE03 study as to how people are going to do.
Did you separately argue the 24-week point before the board?
Yes, we did. Refer you to page 44822.
Which volume is this?
Which volume is this?
That should be in volume 3.
Okay. Well, unless Judge Chin has further questions at this point, why don't we...
Just one more.
Go ahead.
When it comes to this combination of Vandeput and Kempeny, there's two board decisions that are discussing that combination. One is Coherus, the Coherus IPR. The other one is the Boehringer IPR, right? And I don't recall seeing in your blue brief a retort to the Boehringer rationale for combining Kempeny and Vandeput.
I think it was just taking the same references and running them in the opposite direction.
There seemed to be a routine optimization theory expressed in the Boehringer IPR that wasn't necessarily articulated in the Coherus IPR or board final written decision. So that's why I'm wondering that maybe there's something of a delta between the two board decisions and how they combined these two references.
But I don't think in either of those board decisions that the board is itself accepting a routine optimization theory. And one of the reasons here is it's undisputed. We talk about 96 different combinations just on the face of what's disclosed in the prior art. And so we don't have a sort of small number of easily traversed things to try here. We have 96 different ways you can go, and the board's own reasoning said the way you're going to do this is with clinical studies. So 96 different clinical studies. This is not a matter of sort of easy tweak for the routine optimization. This is unpredictable chemistry. This is chemistry where when AbbVie tried 80 milligrams monthly, failure, no better than placebo. Unpredictable dosing, first to be approved by the FDA.
Okay, well, I think we're out of time. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Medich?
Are there two different rationales for the combination of Vandeput and Kempeny in the two different IPR board decisions?
Your Honor, yes, and may it please the court. I think you can look at the prior art in this case in one of two ways. I think you can either say, you take the DE, you take the DE7, which is the Vandeput reference, with the 20 milligrams and 40 milligrams weekly, and you stretch that out to every 2 weeks. There's a very clear rationale and motive for a person to do that because no one likes being injected more frequently than they have to be, so patients would want to be injected less frequently. Alternatively, you could look at the DE3 reference and say, we have.
When you say DE3 reference, do you mean Kempeny?
Yeah, Kempeny and Rao. Sorry, Your Honor. The Kempeny and Rao report, the early DE3 study, Vandeput reports the later DE7 study. Or you could look at that dose and modify that and say, subcutaneous is more convenient.
In the Coherus IPR, the board rejected that first theory you just expressed, right? The idea of taking Vandeput and stretching it out from a weekly dosage to a biweekly dosage?
I don't think that's exactly what the board was up to. The board looked at the 2 week half-life and said that alone would not counsel in favor of a 2 week dosing regimen. I think that's what the board was saying, but they later said in the Boehringer IPRs that it was a factor. And in fact, in the Coherus IPRs, I think if you look at what they actually said, they sort of hint that it was a factor, which I suspect is probably why Boehringer made that argument.
I'm confused. I'm just talking about the Coherus IPR final written decision.
No, I understood, Your Honor. So in that decision,
there's only one theory, and it's based on leading with Kempeny.
It leads with Kempeny.
You're telling me there's a second theory in there?
No, so what the argument for motivation to combine them was one of the theories that was offered in the Coherus IPR was that if you look at the half-life of the drug, it was known to be about 2 weeks. And so one of skill in the art would have said, well, a 2-week dosing regimen based on that fact, would have been obvious. The board rejected the idea that half-life alone was sufficient to get you from...
Right, yeah. But the board didn't adopt any second theory that led with Vandeput in the Coherus IPR final written decision. Am I right?
I don't think so.
Then where did it say, yes, you could start with Vandeput and you could legitimately, reasonably expect that it would, you could extend it out from a weekly to biweekly dosage?
In the Coherus IPR?
Right. That's what we've been talking about.
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the board necessarily had to decide which one you would start with, because the reasoning was that from the combination of the two, you would have gotten there. And in all events, the board clearly did find that in the Boehringer IPRs, so, and found the same claims invalid. So even if the board didn't find that there, they didn't find it there.
There was only one theory in Coherus. It was leading with Kempeny and then switching over from 0.5 milligrams to kilogram to a fixed dosage of 40 milligrams, and then changing over from intravenous to subcutaneous and relying on Vandeput for those two things.
Yes.
It never, in the Coherus IPR, made any kind of finding of motivation to extend Vandeput's weekly dosages to a biweekly and then double up in the Coherus IPR.
So in
the Boehringer IPR, yes, but I've been talking to you for the past 3 minutes about the Coherus IPR.
So in the Coherus IPR, the board said Kempeny expressly discloses a dose that is equivalent to the recited subcutaneous 40 milligram dose. Kempeny also teaches biweekly administration. Accordingly, Kempeny explicitly provides motivation for converting Vandeput's weekly dosing regimen from DE7 into a biweekly dosing regimen. That's at Appendix 70 and 71. Does that answer the question, Your Honor?
Go ahead and go on.
So I'd also like to address what my colleague on the other side said regarding the patients being shifted off the dose. I think that's not... I think that's a little misleading because of the breadth of these claims. Because these claims cover treatment of any patient, the fact that even some patients were still having success with the dose as of week 12 would teach these claims. So in type...
What does the record show about patients being shifted off of doses?
I think it reflects what Your Honor discussing with my colleague on the other side, is that it's a little unclear exactly why they were shifted off. You do point to the...
There are two different issues here. One is, were patients shifted off of doses before 12 weeks and then after 12 weeks? Surely after 12 weeks, the patients receiving the 0.5 milligram dose were shifted off or were up-dosed according to the thing to test safety. But I thought there was a suggestion that there was shifting off the 0.5 dose before 12 weeks. Did that happen?
I believe it did, but I think the record's unclear. But I think the point is that...
Well, why were they shifted off before the 12 weeks when this determination was made to conduct the safety analysis?
I don't think the record discloses that, but what I would say is that it doesn't matter for these claims.
No, but I'm just trying to understand what the record does show about it. Does it show that before 12 weeks, people were shifted off the 0.5 dose?
I don't think the record is clear about that. It says some were up-dosed, but it doesn't...
Before 12 weeks.
It says some were up-dosed, and I think it's...
Before 12 weeks.
I think it's ambiguous on that point. I don't think it says one way or the other. It says that some were up-dosed. It says some were up-dosed, but I don't think it explicitly says that they were up-dosed along the way. That's clearly Abby's position, but I don't think it matters because...
What about all patients that were initially getting 0.5? Were they all up-dosed?
So that's the inference from the chart in Rao that when you get to 12 weeks, because that it ends there, that there was no one any longer on that dose. But I don't think that matters, because if you look at the chart, it clearly shows that there's substantial success. They improved 30% from baseline. 42% of them at some point had received an ACR 20 response. And if you look at 151, the petitioner argued, and the board notes that Remicade, which was the competitor drug, was only doing between 30 and 38% ACR 20 response. So it's hard to say that something that was more successful than the competitor drug that was then on the market is not adequately successful for claims that admittedly cover even something that doesn't improve a patient's health but just slows their decline. And so the fact that some patients were being updosed because they weren't performing well, however that's defined, and it's not clear from the record, but whatever that means, the fact that some patients were receiving benefit from the drug, which is all that's necessary to make these claims obvious. And I think it might be helpful to look at this court's decision in Tyco, where there was, in the prior art, there were higher doses disclosed in the prior art, and then there was one teaching of the claimed lower dose for a subset of patients. Because the claims in that case weren't limited to a particular subset of patients, this court found that sufficient to disclose it as obvious. This court has generally treated these dosing patents as a routine optimization within a range, because as the board found at 31 and 37, what doctors do in these circumstances is tailor particular doses to particular patients. So if you're looking for 31 and 37, the board said that a skilled artisan designing a dosing regimen through clinical trials would have balanced efficacy with other factors, including safety and patient preference. So the fact that there was, you weren't.
If you look at Rao at 28085, where it says patients with 0.05 milligram body weight over 12 weeks resulted in a moderate DAS response in 78% of the patients. Is there something wrong with that figure?
Is that teaching success with 0.5 milligram per kilogram?
I would say that's teaching success. The what Your Honor pointed to in Campeni actually covers 0.5 to 10 milligrams. That cites the same 78% figure. And the 42%.
And then and on 2704, which is in Campeni in Table 2, it reports weekly 0.5 milligram as receiving an ACR 20 response, 70% of them, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but the weekly 0.5 subcutaneous injection, so that's the maximum ACR response, ACR 20 response. So there's also how they were doing over the course of time, which I think might account for the difference there. So if at some point you had 70% getting an ACR 20 response, but then that later declined, and I think that might account for Rao's disclosure of 42% at any given time.
But I thought the chart 4 and 5 in Rao, at 28087 and 28088, show that at 12 weeks, the 0.5 is about the same as the other dosages, right?
No, I think that's right. Very clearly, the trend lines for the 0.5 milligram per kilogram dose is not substantially different than the other ones, which is why I don't think it's appropriate to attribute the updosing, whenever it occurred, to a overall lack of efficacy.
Just to understand those graphs a little better, is it possible that what's going on in the latter half of that 12-week cycle with the 0.5 milligrams is that those data points are now including people that have been moved from placebo to the 0.5 milligram dosage?
That may be. I don't think I consider that possibility, but that that could be. But there's still...
Were they also moving people from the placebo to the higher doses?
Yes. So there were people in the placebo group that were the 1 milligram per kilogram placebo group that then would have been put on to that at that point as well. So you would have seen a similar trend line.
There were people going from placebo straight to 1 milligram.
Yeah, there were people
going straight from placebo to 3 milligram.
Yes. There were people that were receiving 3 milligrams of placebo, and then those people were brought into their ordinary cohort at the point where they took patients off. And so if you were on the 3 milligram per kilogram placebo, then you would have been brought into the the 3 milligram per kilogram dose range once they ended the placebo portion of the study.
What about the lower bioavailability concern with adjusting from intravenous to subcutaneous administration? It appears that the board was relying on the idea that, well, 0.5 milligrams per kilogram is the equivalent of a fixed dosage of 40 milligrams. Kempenny, you could just take that and go to a subcutaneous biweekly administration, and then we would arrive at the claims.
So I think that's right, Your Honor. So before the board...
But then the counter argument to that is, well, you're going to get a lower bioavailability by administering subcutaneously, so you're not going to get the same effect as you would by administering intravenously.
So that's as a general proposition, that's right. But in 28081, at the very end of Kempenny says that's not the case for Humira here. And as for the convertibility of fixed and weight-based doses, the patent owner conceded before the board the equivalent of a 0.5 milligram per kilogram and a 40 milligram dose, because the average patient is about 80 kilograms, so we need to be able to detect they're approximately the same.
Okay. Anything further? So
the end of the bottom of the first column on the last page of Kempenny, 28081. The intravenous patients receiving the drug by subcutaneous and the intravenous injection, respectively, the safety. The bottom of the run-over paragraph, investigators concluded that D2E7 given subcutaneously was safe and as effective when administered intravenously.
Okay.
Unless the court has further questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Saunders, you have 2 minutes.
Picking up on that last point, at 6134, Comparisys experts asked about this intravenous comparison. It's study that has no intravenous. Question, is no intravenous arm in that study correct? Answer, as far as I know, there is not. Questions, what does the intravenous administration think referred to in that statement? Answer, I don't know. But what we do see is on the face of Rao 2000, one of the main references here, an express statement at 28089 in the appendix that, quote, intravenous administration gives advantages. Statement that the board never. Cycling back to updosing for a minute, Judge, I just want to put the statement about 78% that you're talking about on the first page of Rao as a statement about the DE04 study is the weekly study, not the at least every other week study that's being relied on for obviousness. And on updosing, I think if one thing that's come clear from this argument today is the sheer amount of uncertainty from the faces of these references. Our experts talked about updosing and their interpretation of it at 31387 of the appendix. The question was put to BI's expert. Where does it tell us in those figures how many patients were being dosed at 0.5 milligram per kilogram? Answer, it doesn't tell you how many patients were there. It tells you that those were all the patients that were there at that dose level. And it goes on to say there were some were offered higher doses. Yes, there was updosing. But if the updosing is going to be dismissed on the ground that this was just converting people for reasons of safety, or on the ground, I think, contrary to the record, that didn't happen after 12 weeks, where are the board's findings? It didn't make those findings. It left that uncertainty hanging and counted against us as the patent owner, which was improper.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Senators. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.